This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Healthy Aging, providing you with the unique energy support of Pure NT Factor. NT Factor is the only nutritional formula clinically proven to reduce fatigue, whatever the cause, whether it be age, illness, or just being run down. NT Factor from Nutritional Therapeutics repairs damaged cells and restores healthy bacteria in your digestive tract. Clinical trials have shown NT Factor reduces fatigue by almost half, and it even reverses some symptoms of aging. I've been taking NT Factor for years with a 45-day money-back guarantee of nothing to lose. To order, call 800-982-9158. That's 800-982-9158. Or go to ntfactor.com. That's ntfactor.com. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. The subject for today, you know, I'm sure you've heard about this, intravenous vitamins, in particular intravenous vitamin C. That's been a mainstay of integrative medicine practice for a long time. People get IV drips, so-called, and intravenous vitamin C has been shown to be helpful for immune problems. It's been shown to be supportive in cancer treatment. It's a wonderful therapy, but the science is a little murky. So today we're going to turn to a true pioneer in this field, one of my good colleagues. I've known her for, well, too many decades to recount. She's Dr. Jeannie Drisco. Dr. Drisco is a medical doctor who has headed up the integrative medicine program at the University of Kansas Medical Center. She was named the U. Reardon Professorship in Orthomolecular Medicine at the University of Kansas Medical Center in 2007. She's a longtime practitioner of integrative medicine, as I am. In parallel lives, both of us have been presidents of the American College for the Advancement of Medicine, ACAM, which is an organization formed by alternative medical doctors who practice chelation therapy. In fact, Dr. Drisco was instrumental in the TACT study, a study that ultimately vindicated and validated the efficacy of chelation therapy. She's done innumerable things. She's taught doctors. She's written many, many scientific articles. She's kind of the ideal bridge between practice of integrative medicine and academics. She has managed to get into the belly of the beast of academe at prestigious, consortia and teaching organizations, which is quite an accomplishment because sometimes it's like, you know, integrated medicine is sort of on the outside, conventional medicine is on the inside. She's managed to transcend the boundaries, so to speak, in her career. So, Jeannie, it's a pleasure having you on Intelligent Medicine. Thanks for joining us today.
Wow, Ron, thank you. I didn't recognize myself there for a minute.
I glossed over so many of the things that you've done in your professional career. But I wanted to focus today on your pioneering work with intravenous vitamin C. And so take us back a couple of decades or more. When you first became interested in the potential for high doses of vitamin C, now, you know, not just taking a couple of ester Cs a day, but really concentrated, tens of grams of vitamin C delivered intravenously, the potential for that to help.
You know, it's really interesting, and you were talking about the research. I think that's what's really critical here, is that we have these beliefs, and they're almost like religious beliefs, but until you put the feet to the fire, you really don't know what's true and what's not true. Mm-hmm. So in my training, I trained under Hugh Reardon, and he was one of the pioneer, really one of the first people in the United States to really advance intravenous vitamin C. So I got interested in it there. I saw young people coming in, they'd been in college and they had mononucleosis and they were told, you're so sick, you can't come back to school for a month. And in Hugh's clinic, the Reardon clinic, he would give them intravenous vitamin C, 25 grams, and he, the first day they were there and they were just sleeping in their chair. The second day they came for their infusion and they were sitting up in the chair and starting to read. The third day they had their backpack with them and they were doing their homework.
Right.
And they were well. So it was really captured.
Yeah.
Remarkable. So it was an anti-infective agent. And then I saw cancer patients that had lymphoma, and it had it for a number of years, but it was receiving the intravenous vitamin C, and their lymphoma disappeared. So it really captured my imagination. And then I was invited to go to the University of Kansas Medical Center, and I decided that was going to be one of my research agendas. So I
And by the
really
way, this is really kind of, I might mention, you know, you mentioned this rather casually. It's kind of an unprecedented thing because you were a known advocate of integrative therapies, and for, you know, prestigious medical school to invite you to head up a department of integrative medicine within a conservative institution was quite a landmark, wasn't it?
Well, it was a funny time because in the 90s, all of the medical centers wanted to have an integrative medicine program. Mm-hmm. It was like a cool thing to do.
Yeah.
So they didn't know what they were getting. I mean, they just wanted one. So I started the program at KU. And in an academic center, you're really supposed to do patient care and research and teach and provide service to the community or to the nation. And so I really wanted to do all four of those things.
That's kind of a tough balancing act because, you know, in effect, you have to cooperate with the other physicians there, you know, say the oncologists who might be saying, okay, here's your chemotherapy. Then they go over to the integrative clinic. And they receive intravenous vitamin C. That must have raised some eyebrows.
Well, it was insidious. It was the camel's nose under
maybe,
the tent. So
maybe
to
the
speak.
Word is diplomatic. You know,
well,
you used expert diplomacy.
Absolutely, it helped, and it helped that I knew some of the oncologists as well from my days in medical school. So that helped bridge that as well, but. What happened was we started with different types of cancer that were so terrible that there was really not a lot you could do. And so when we added the vitamin C as part of a research project, it was really eye-opening for a lot of the oncologists, and they accepted it. Hmm. So it was a good way to move into it by starting the research.
Okay, so I mean, clearly, we in this field, we have been rather, shall we say, innovative. Some would say, you know, maybe reckless in applying this therapy because we felt strongly that there was benefit, that it was antiviral, that it could support the immune system, that it could inhibit the growth of cancer cells and ultimately improve the outcome in cancer. But what you've done, quite interestingly, you've done some of the research, and you've looked at also some of the other people who are doing the basic science research that shows why it might be plausible that it works.
That's absolutely been very important to move this field forward. My great friend Mark Levine at the NIH did some early pioneering work with vitamin C, and he was training his postdoc, Kay Chin. And she was there 5 years and doing some phenomenal research with just the basic cells and animals, testing vitamin C to see what happened with cancer and in the tissues. So when she finished, I was fortunate to have her come and work with me at KU. So she's an independent researcher at the University of Kansas Medical Center, and has her own lab and continuing that basic science research. And out of all of this, this wonderful partnership, out of all of this, we found out that vitamin C, you can't take it by mouth. You can't, even if it's in a liposomal form.
Yeah, because a lot of people will say, oh, you know, that sounds good. I'll take a lot of vitamin C, you know, originally it was Linus Pauling who's talking about, the loading dose of vitamin C, take it to bowel tolerance, take 15, 20 grams until you get loose bowel movements. But that doesn't quite work the same as intravenous, does it?
It doesn't. The oral vitamin C is a vitamin, and the body has a mechanism to just get enough absorbed. And then it's excreted very rapidly through the kidneys and through the bowel. So you cannot get it in the bloodstream at a higher concentration than a very preset small amount. But when you put it in the vein, give it directly as an intravenous infusion, it becomes a drug and it bypasses that tight control, so to speak. So all of a sudden you get a spike of vitamin C in the bloodstream and it pushes it into the tissues, into the muscles and the extracellular space. So this is not something that can be done orally. It has to be done intravenously.
So it's natural, but in a sense you're using it as a pharmaceutical drug at that level. You're really taking a natural substance and you're making it available to the body in much higher concentrations than you can ordinarily get from, say, an orange or something, right?
That's absolutely accurate.
Yeah. So we're not talking about preventing scurvy here or,
No.
Preventing the common cold. So when these high doses of vitamin C are applied, what are some of the cautions? Is there the potential risks to patients in doing so? Do you have to monitor, say, kidney function, for example, that kind of consideration?
Well, we gave thousands and thousands of doses in controlled trials now, and my colleagues around the country have joined, or actually around the world, have joined us in this research. And what we found is that infusing high doses, even as much as 125 grams, not milligrams, grams of vitamin C, is remarkably safe. We don't see side effects. But as you said, there are some precautions you have to take.
Right.
You have to make sure the kidneys are in good shape. They're functioning well. And that's a simple blood test. And we have to make sure that the patient has a normal blood test called G6PD. Mm-hmm. And if that G6PD is abnormal, then the patient's blood will break apart when the vitamin C is infused, and they could have abnormal drop in their hemoglobin hematocrit, their blood count.
And I'll tell you what that looks like, because I actually had a patient that I recall very well who came to see me after having received a very high dose. I think he got 100 of vitamin C somewhere else where they weren't cautious and they didn't check his G6PD. And also he was African American, which is, puts you at a little higher risk for having that genetic, glitch. By the way, do you know offhand how common that genetic, variation is? It's relatively uncommon. Maybe less than 1% of the population has that.
It's very uncommon, but in an African American patient, or someone who is Southern Italian descent or Mediterranean descent, you have to check it. You cannot assume it's going to be okay.
Particularly important. I mean, less likely in a Scandinavian, but, still, it's worth checking. It's a simple test, doesn't cost very much. So anyway, what happened was he came to see me and he said, I really feel awful. And, I said, let's do a blood test and a urinalysis. And right away, when we collected the urine, we could see it was very dark.
Oh, gosh.
And that is a sign of something called hemolysis, which means that the blood cells literally burst under the stress of the high dose vitamin C. I mean, this is very rare. This is people who have that particular issue. And we then determined that he had when the blood test came in, it said, yes, he had the G6PD deficiency. He lost a fair amount of blood volume that way. And it can be dangerous. It can clog your kidney with debris from the breakdown of the red blood cells and even lead to kidney failure. He was fine. We hydrated him, and made sure that he flushed out his kidneys. But, that's a consideration. Okay.
It is.
Yeah.
But again, I want to emphasize that in the thousands and thousands of doses that we have given in controlled trials, it was remarkable how better the patients felt, even when they were getting their chemotherapy, and it did not interfere right. with the chemotherapy delivery. It didn't reduce the effectiveness of the chemotherapy. And the chemotherapy was actually enhanced by the vitamin C. Mm-hmm. So there was a synergistic or a combined effect to increase the effectiveness of the chemotherapy.
Now, so interesting, because you know as well as I do that we're fighting an uphill battle sometimes when we offer patients nutritional support while they're getting chemo or radiation. And there are actually some studies that suggest that, you know, taking antioxidants when you're taking certain types of chemo can vitiate the benefits of the chemo. I mean, let's admit, I mean, that it's not necessarily a free pass to take all the supplements you want when you're taking at least certain forms of chemo. You have to be selective about what supplements you take. But intravenous vitamin C at that level works differently, doesn't it? It's not really a protective thing. It's not an antioxidant at that level. In fact, it's a bit of a pro-oxidant, is it not?
Exactly, exactly. And that's, again, part of that pharmaceutical or that drug effect of giving the vitamin C in the vein. Because when it gets into the tissues, what we call the extracellular space, mm-hmm. it turns into hydrogen peroxide. It's particularly toxic to cancer cells because they can't mop that up. They can't mm-hmm. get rid of it like normal cells. So it's very targeted to abnormal cells.
So the idea being that cancer cells are kind of a stripped down version, rapidly growing but primitive mm-hmm. of normal cells. Mm-hmm. They lack some of the protective mechanisms that would protect the rest of ourselves from the potentially adverse effects of really high dose of vitamin C. Is that the basic theory?
That's absolutely correct. That is such a cool thing when you think about it.
Yeah.
That a wonderfully non-toxic solution given in the vein can target cancer cells because, as you said, they're primitive and all they want to do is divide and conquer, and they just get rid of all of the protective effects that normal cells have.
And actually, that's the basis of conventional therapies too, because if chemotherapy, which is poisonous, poisoned all our cells, you know, we would simply get a dose of chemo and we would die. I mean, what ends up happening is, yeah, there is some toxicity, but hopefully it's more directed at the cancer cells, which are more vulnerable. Same thing with radiation. Radiation targets vulnerable cancer cells, and, hopefully, if it's administered correctly, it doesn't do that much collateral damage. And then similarly, we can look at vitamin C as that kind of agent. So, is there evidence? I mean, this is, and probably there's just not enough research, but is there evidence that vitamin C either helps prolong the lives of patients or helps patients survive or helps cure patients? And again, we're not talking about intravenous vitamin C as a standalone. We're often talking about it in conjunction with conventional treatments. But various cancers respond better than others, or what's the deal?
Well, that's a very good question. We do see in our clinical trials, again, they're controlled trials. And so far in our center, we've looked at ovarian cancer. We've looked at pancreatic cancer. We're in the middle of a bladder cancer trial right now. And what we do see is those patients feel better and they have prolonged life. There is a benefit when adding vitamin C to conventional therapies. Now, why we can't use it as a standalone therapy is because that would not be considered standard of care. Right. And so we have to, again, it's that diplomacy. You have right. to do things in a certain way.
Right. You'd almost have to do that like offshore, and it
would be, I think so.
Because standard of care means, when you're looking at patients who have heart problems, you might administer chelation therapy, but you've got to keep them on all their other medications because otherwise it'd be denying them what is thought to be evidence-based care. So you can't really do a pit vitamin intravenous vitamin C against chemotherapy. You really have to use it adjunctively. I guess that's the idea. But clearly, it has a synergistic benefit. So what's happened to the research? Is it ongoing, or are they shutting the door on this, as so often happens with promising alternative therapies?
Well, they're not shutting the. It's been getting harder to get funding. That's mm-hmm. for sure. Mm-hmm. We've been trying to get the NIH to fund our second ovarian cancer study, and we have oncologists on board. We have different medical centers on board, but the NIH says, you know, why would we study this? It's a waste of our dollars. Mm. So we're persisting. And I think that's what you just have to keep doing is being persistent because we showed in our first ovarian cancer trial it was effective.
And, you know, why do you think that is? You know, clearly we have a model for introducing new drugs and therapies, and they all come from the conventional side, and they're often underwritten by pharmaceutical industry. They stand to become very profitable drugs. That's where a lot of the emphasis is these days in oncology. You know, we're hearing about very targeted, you know, laser-like interventions, personalized medicine, you know, customized, mm-hmm. You know, monoclonal antibodies and things like that, that, you know, literally cost tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars a year and may prolong patients' lives for a few months, but on the basis of that, they get approved. Double standard when it comes to, you know, something simple.
Absolutely
like vitamin
C. A double standard. Yeah. Absolutely a double standard. You know, we don't have a huge power base behind us in natural medicine research, and we don't have huge advocates in Congress to push this through at the NIH level, and they don't honestly believe at the NIH level that it's really that important. But the evidence is growing. There's multiple centers all around using this.
What about, you know, to change the subject slightly, there's quite a buzz doctor in Virginia, I don't know his name, but you're probably very familiar with him, was using it in the ICU
yes.
for critically ill patients and, mm-hmm. you know, was getting marvelous results. What became of that?
Well, there's actually two different researchers. One is Barry Fowler. Alpha Fowler is
right.
his given name. That's what he goes by in his papers. But
he's
Barry Fowler.
Norfolk, Virginia, right? Something like that.
He said, yes, Virginia Commonwealth mm-hmm. University. And his original research, including the basic science, showed it was just a very exciting opportunity. But then his most recent publication in JAMA was rather tepid.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like it was dumbed down to make it look like it wasn't that effective. And then Paul Merrick, who's also in Virginia, got a consortium together, and the lead investigator was at Emory. And again, very tepid results, but it was interesting. They had patients coming from the ICU that were septic, identified to be septic, mm-hmm. and then they were admitted to the ICU, and then they had to screen them for the study. And Merrick, what he does is he makes sure that those patients, as soon as they hit the ER, they get started with their IV vitamin C. Mm-hmm. That's his real world experience. Mm-hmm. But in the research, they were waiting as long as 12 hours. And in some septic patients, that's too long.
Mm-hmm.
So again, very tepid results. So I think so what's happened now is nobody believes that IV vitamin C is helpful for septic patients in the ICU now, which is extraordinarily unfortunate.
Mm-hmm. I think they, again, the bias towards acceptance of it is extreme. And, you know, if it had been pushed by a major pharmaceutical company that stood to, you know, have a multi-million-dollar bonanza as a result of marketing this new drug. I mean, it's an old natural substance. I think we'd see more of an impetus to prove its benefits.
Absolutely. You know, another interesting thing, too, in talking about other therapies is chelation therapy. Chelation isn't just the EDTA chelation, as you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's got multiple components in it, and one of the components is vitamin C at
pretty
7 grams.
Yeah, pretty high dose.
It
yeah.
is.
Yeah.
And so I think some of the benefit in the endothelium and the red blood cell is related to the vitamin C. And I know this because of some of Mark Levine's work at the NIH that hasn't entirely been published yet. So I don't think that it's just the chelation with the EDTA itself that's the showing the benefit. And of course, there's B vitamins and magnesium and all kinds of things in that cocktail.
Okay. Well, okay, the plot thickens, though, and I want to talk a little bit about the politics of intravenous vitamin C and the economics of intravenous vitamin C, because a lot of doctors who are administering intravenous vitamin C along with other intravenous therapies are kind of feeling a pinch these days. Regulatory, financial, it's becoming harder to source vitamin C. And we'll talk a little bit about what's happening on that front. It's a therapy that's alive and well. You can get intravenous therapy at many, many integrative centers across the country. But rather than becoming more available, it's actually throttling down in terms of availability. We'll talk a little bit about that with today's guest. Jeannie Dusko, MD, is a former head of integrative medicine at KUMC, Kansas University Medical Center, integrative medicine division there. I don't know if I hit the formally that's the name of it, but that's an S.
Oh, it's close enough.
Close enough. Yeah. Close enough for government work, so they say. Okay. Okay, so we'll pause for a few moments. In part two, we'll focus more on the potential of high-dose intravenous vitamin C for a variety of conditions. With today's guest, Dr. Jeannie Dusko. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is Intelligent Medicine.